Our next speaker is Dr. Eric Jensen, who is currently the Associate Professor of Surgery in the Division of Surgical Oncology at the University of Minnesota Medical Center and is the current President of the Minnesota Surgical Society of the American College of Surgeons. Dr. Jensen will be speaking today about perioperative management strategies for elective general surgery.
So thank you very much. My task initially I thought was sort of a simple one, but actually when you sort of look at all the data and the different scores that we have, I really ended up making this an effort to essentially solidify or kind of organize my two previous speakers' content to try to make it as simple a process as possible and something that people can remember as far as an easy way to prepare patients for elective surgeries. I have no disclosures that are related to this talk. I think it almost feels like more than this to me, but basically 1 out of 10 patients that we operate on is on some form of anticoagulation, and another whole group of patients is on dual antiplatelet therapies, and then there's a whole other group of patients who are just taking aspirin because they think it's good for them. So it is a large problem. It's something that everybody deals with really commonly. So I was essentially tasked with discussing how to create a patient-centered perioperative management plan. And I would also give a plug to the manuscript that Melissa and Andy really headed up. I would encourage all of you to take a look at it because some of this is hard to put in slides, but there's really great summaries of everything that we're discussing in that. So when you're considering a patient, essentially there's a lot of different things that we've just talked about. And they have to do with the overall procedural risk of bleeding. They have to do with the thromboembolism risk for individual patients. And then really as another category on its own, there's a whole separate issue with cardiac risk in patients that have had catheter-based interventions or valve replacements or things like that. And on one side of the equation, all these things affect, as you've just heard from my colleagues, they affect how you determine what to do with their medicines before surgery, whether you have to bridge or not. But there's a whole nother competing set of issues, and some of these are really hard to measure, and actually they're impossible to measure, frankly. But there's individual case variability. There's surgeon preferences, and it's sort of a well-known fact that we don't talk about a lot, but surgeons have a tendency to do what they were trained to do. And so sometimes as some of these newer medications come on, it becomes difficult to change practice, even though it may be appropriate. There's a lot of myths about anticoagulation, frankly. There's a lot of overestimation of risk of bleeding and things like that, too. And so I have colleagues and friends who really think that even perioperative low-dose heparin products raise the risk of major bleeding. So there's a lot of myths that go along with these medicines, too. It's a whole separate topic that we're going to hear about next when it comes to emergency procedures and how to manage these. And obviously, patient comorbidities play a big role in how you decide what your perioperative plan is going to be. So I want to just go through the mechanisms of action for the common drugs that we see, all of which have been sort of touched on already. But the first and most commonly, best known, are the antithrombin 3 mediated drugs, and that basically includes fractionated and unfractionated heparin. And in parentheses, I've included the half-lives of these drugs because that has a lot to do with how long you hold them and things like that. So the heparin products essentially have a fairly short half-life. That's something that we I think everybody in the room is familiar with. The vitamin K agonist, essentially that's Coumadin with a much longer half-life. And now, as you've heard, we've got not only a direct thrombin inhibitor, which is Pradax or Dabigatran, but also factor 10A inhibitors. So these last two categories are essentially the direct oral anticoagulants is what we're sort of referring to them. But they include Xarelto, Eliquis, Savesa. I think more and more, I've certainly noticed in my own practice, but more and more these drugs are kind of taking over what warfarin used to be. And that's actually caused some issues essentially because a lot of people are still practicing as if they're the same as warfarin. We're going to get into emergency surgery, so I won't spend too much time on these, but each of these does have essentially reversal agents that can be used that Annie's going to discuss coming up, so I won't talk about those. On the antiplatelet side of things, I think most people are familiar with this also. One of the issues, obviously, is that once you give these medicines, they stick around for a long time. But they all are basically ADP receptor antagonists. And again, we'll talk about how to manage that in the urgent situation coming up. So I won't focus on that either. So I'm really just going to walk through for each of these classes of drugs kind of a standardized way, and it is fairly simplified because I didn't want to get too much into the weeds about some of the CHADS scores and things like that. So what I'm really trying to do is put sort of take-home thoughts that should be fairly straightforward. But for patients that are on either unfractionated or low molecular weight heparin, if you've got somebody in the hospital on a heparin drip, essentially it's very simple. You just hold the drip 6 hours before their surgery. For lower risk surgeries in a low risk patient, you can actually hold it for longer than that, but essentially holding it for 6 hours is a fairly safe thing to do. It has a very short half-life, and for most patients it'll be out of their system without any risk to without any increased risk of bleeding for your procedure. For Lovenox, it's a little bit longer. I think, again, these are drugs that most everyone in the room, I'm sure, is familiar with. So the standard for Lovenox is essentially to hold it 24 hours prior to a major surgery. One of the other difficulties is when to resume these drugs, and that's another issue that there are so many variables that go along with that. The individual surgery, the individual patient, a surgery that you thought might end up being low risk for bleeding, maybe it was more difficult than you thought. So it's very hard to give a standardized answer as far as when to start these. I think probably the safest thing is you start them as soon as you think it's safe, and typically that's within 48 to 72 hours after surgery. For cases that are low risk bleeding, it's safer to start them sooner. Warfarin, again, a medicine that I'm sure everyone in the room has dealt with quite a bit. So it's no secret, we just heard also from Paul. Essentially, the standard for warfarin is to hold it for 5 days prior to an elective surgery. And you can really start it a little bit sooner than some of the other medicines just because it takes a few days for it to take effect. So you can essentially give people their Coumadin back the day of surgery or the next day for most cases. So it's a little bit more complicated for the direct oral anticoagulants, for dabigatran. And the others, they are affected by renal function. And so patients that have normal renal function, Paul actually mentioned also, essentially you can hold them for 2 days prior to a high-risk procedure or just 1 day prior to a low-risk procedure. And similar to Lovenox, essentially you can start them 2 to 3 days after a high-risk procedure and potentially 1 day after a low-risk procedure. And I think this is actually something that I know at my own hospital, we have a problem because even if I know in my office that I want to hold these drugs just for a couple of days prior to surgery, we still have issues with the perioperative nursing team that calls patients before their surgery who treat these drugs as if they were Coumadin. And so we have patients frequently being told, or sometimes actually by their medical doctor as well, they're being told, no, you have to hold that for 5 days as if it's Coumadin. Really, that's not true. These are very predictable pharmacology that these drugs have. So really, you don't have to hold them nearly as long. For patients that have impaired renal function, that is important to think about for these drugs. Essentially, you just double the time that you hold them. So if a patient has impaired renal function, for high-risk surgeries, they do need to hold them for 4 days. And for low-risk surgeries, 2 days is enough. And again, resuming them after surgery as a sort of generalized rule is anywhere from 1 to 3 days after your surgery, just depending on the risk of bleeding that you feel that they have. So these medicines, the factor 10A inhibitors are fairly similar, so I didn't bother to break it down by renal function again, but they basically have the exact same as the dabigatran. So essentially holding them for 2 days for high-risk bleeding and holding them for 1 day for low-risk procedures, and then again starting them anywhere between 1 to 3 days after. For platelets, it's sort of a separate issue as well, and I think most people are especially familiar with Plavix, but the others are very similar as well. Essentially, it's holding them for 5 to 7 days for low or high risk bleeding. There really isn't a difference. And again, you resume them as soon as you feel that it's safe to do so. Aspirin has a, I added aspirin a little bit as a, as its own little box, only because when people are on dual antiplatelet therapy for, typically for catheter-based interventions for their heart, that is a separate issue that you do need to consider. So ideally, if someone's just taking aspirin because they think it's a healthy thing to do, holding it for 7 to 10 days is a reasonable thing to do. But as my colleagues have mentioned, if you have patients that are on dual antiplatelet therapy, it really behooves you to speak to their cardiologist to make sure that everybody's on the same page when you're getting ready to hold these medicines, so that you really have a good understanding between the two of you what the risk of a coronary event will be. This is a little bit of a busy slide, so I tried to make it as big as possible, but obviously patients with coronary stents, I think, deserve sort of a category of their own. And this essentially summarizes some of the things that Paul was just mentioning also. But basically, when you think about patients who have a coronary stent, the critical thing is whether it's a bare metal stent or a drug-eluting stent. And clearly, the drug-eluting stents have a much higher risk of thrombosis. So a bare metal stent, if they're out 30 days after their stent placement, essentially it's safe to discontinue their antiplatelet agents. For patients who require some sort of intervention and they've had that stent placed less than 30 days, then it really depends on what the risk of delaying that surgery is relative to the risk of them having a cardiac event. And those are really hard to quantify, so that's obviously something that you would be working with a cardiologist to discuss. But essentially, if possible, you want to delay that surgery to get them at least to the 30-day point. In drug-eluting stents, it's a whole different picture because of the risk of thrombosis. And so ideally, those patients, it's best if surgery can be avoided even for a year. Now, obviously, that's not always going to be possible, whether it's an issue related to a cancer or some other thing like that, or an emergency procedure that needs to be done. But again, if it's over a year, then it's less of an issue because the drugs have already gone, essentially. And so if you're over a year, stopping the antiplatelet therapy is a safe thing to do. When patients are under a year, then again, it's sort of a balance of what's the risk of delaying surgery versus proceeding with surgery and having a cardiac event. So I just wanted to, these are busy slides, but I wanted to finish up by sort of highlighting the manuscript a little bit and all the work that went into it, particularly by Melissa and Annie. But these are actually directly out of the manuscript, so as I said, I would encourage everyone to look at it, but there's two particular tables in it. This is one of them, and this essentially goes through the guidelines. Everything that I basically just said is summarized in this table. It's a really nice resource, I think, and it's easy to get. This is online now, and will be published, I think, in the coming months. Same thing, this is a little bit too much to go through each of these, but again, this is straight out of the manuscript. So this is a nice summary, which really puts together the issues of high-risk bleeding procedure, you know, high risk for bleeding during a procedure versus low-risk procedures, and then also the risk of a thromboembolic event on the other side. So I thought it was a really nice resource. I just wanted to throw that in there and plug the manuscript a little bit also. Thank you very much.